Hello and welcome to Hunt, Find, Alert, the Canine Search and Rescue podcast, where we discuss everything related to the world of canine search and rescue work. As always, I'm your host, Zephyrin Allen, and thank you for joining us today. So today we have a bit of a different episode than things that we've done previously. Everything that we've done previously has primarily been focused around the dog itself. I wanted to do something a little bit different today because I think this topic is as equally as important as working with our dogs are. And so today we're going to discuss critical incident stress management and how we take care of ourselves and our teammates. This is a topic that's very important, but it's something that we do a great job of ignoring, I think, at least in my experience in the SAR community. But it's something I do want to focus on because our well-being is also important. And it's important that we look after ourselves and our teammates to make sure that we are processing situations that we may run into in the correct manner that's safe for us and safe for our teammates, et cetera. So in order to have this discussion, I invited Mr. Ian Maslin onto our show. Ian, how are you doing today? And thank you for joining.
I'm doing very well. Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Great. I appreciate your time. So what we like to do here, Ian, is we like to get a good background of you and what you've done, both professionally and your SAR background. So if you wouldn't mind, just tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you currently live at, and tell us what you do in your professional life.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from London, England, in the United Kingdom. I was a medic with the London Ambulance Service there before I emigrated to Canada in 2001. So currently living in the Eastern Fraser Valley in a small community called Agassiz, so just outside of Harrison Hot Springs. Mm-hmm. And my day job, I'm a community rural nurse with Fraser Health, which is a health authority in British Columbia. And yeah, I've been with Search and Rescue for just close to 15 years now.
All right, good deal. So tell us a little bit about your experience working with critical incident stress management and what you've done in that realm.
Yeah, so I got involved in critical incident stress management through the BC Search and Rescue Association. So when I joined my search and rescue team, I discovered that they had a CISM team. So CISM is critical incident stress management. And I applied to join, and this is where we're at.
Perfect. Well, tell us a little bit about your search and rescue background. So how did you get into search and rescue? You mentioned you've been doing it for about 15 years, and tell us a little bit about your team as well.
Okay. So I joined search and rescue. It was a challenge. I was in therapy. I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder in 2008, 2009. So through therapy, they challenged me to give back to the community and to maybe use my experiences where I can. So just so happened that they have an annual parade in town, and the search and rescue were part of that parade. And one of the guys came up to me and said, "You look like a fit, strong man, you need to join." So, you know, and that's history, as so to speak. So the team name is Kent Harrison Search and Rescue. So we're located in the district of Kent in Agassiz and Harrison Hot Springs. So Kent Harrison Search and Rescue.
All right, very good. About what size is your team and what type of missions do you all typically respond to?
The team, we generally run around 30 members, give or take a few, and we respond to mountainous terrain, so forest service roads. We get lots of backcountry people recreating with ATVs, quads, side-by-sides. And we have a large lake here, Harrison Lake, which is approximately 250 square kilometers, I believe. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the largest, deepest lakes in southern British Columbia. So we do lots of lake rescues as well.
All right. Very good. I didn't ask before, but I do want to make sure to ask the question. So you mentioned that you joined, I think it was through the BC Search and Rescue Organization that you joined the CISM team. Tell us what your training is in CISM. Tell us your background and how long have you been working in that realm?
Yeah, sure. So I joined the CISM team in 2016. And then when you join the team, you get certified in the two entry-level courses through the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, which is assisting individuals in crisis and group crisis intervention. So I took those two courses and then became a peer SISM responder with the Search and Rescue Association. And, you know, we run one of the largest peer response teams, you know, I'm going to edge a bet in North America. We respond to 3,400 volunteers. So our call volume is running around sort of between 70 and 80 calls a year for critical incident stress responses. And since then, I've taken education. I've gone on to take the advanced courses with the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. And then further to that, I got certified as a traumatologist through the Traumatology Institute of Canada, and then certified in critical incident stress management. And then I went on to become an approved instructor with the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. So with that, I've just completed a new certification that I can take out into the field and teach to the peers that are working, which is a new term, which is called peer para-counseling. And I mean, we can follow up with that a bit later on if you want.
Yeah, I'd love to. So you mentioned that the organizations you work with does peer response. Could you kind of, and just for context, most of the listeners that listen to the show are based in the U.S. So these are kind of some different terms for us. So could you describe what the peer response is that you currently do?
Yeah, so obviously a peer, if we Googled that, we will probably get one of the same. So it means that we share the same experiences, and that's what makes us peers. Mm-hmm. So I know in the States, you know, the peer-based model is quite large. You know, lots of training in the States. I do a lot of my training across the border there. So working with a lot of law enforcement and you know, fire departments. So they do have the peer-based model. You know, it's very well known in the States. So basically, it's just, you know, before we go on to formal therapy, we're using the peer model so we can help ourselves.
Okay. And so just so I'm clear, you as a peer responder, if another SAR team in BC had a specific incident that occurred, you as a peer responder would reach out to that other SAR team and provide them guidance, counseling, support. What does that look like?
Yeah, so it's, they would reach out to us. You know, we have a central sort of 1-800 number that they call mm-hmm. to initiate a response. And yes, we would go out as peers and we would support them through this critical incident stress management program that we have. And we can do group session debriefings, or we can do one-on-one interventions with anybody that requests it.
Okay, very good. Well, then let's jump into the actual episode then, now that we have the background. So I always find it necessary whenever we're talking about a specific topic to define the topic. So if you wouldn't mind, Ian, could you define exactly what critical incident stress management is?
Yeah, so critical incident stress management. So, you know, we break it down as to SISM. So the letters in the term SISM, C-I-S-M, you know, they make up the actual title of the program and the description of the program. And there's many components that make up the SISM continuum of care. So SISM, critical incident stress management, but it's also comprehensive, integrated, systemic, and multi-component. So basically, it's like a toolbox containing many tactics to help mitigate the reactions or effects of people that experience an incident. Most of the tactics operate in the acute reactive stages after an event, a form of psychological first aid, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But more recent studies show that this can be expanded into the subacute stages after an incident. And with more training, and an advanced set of skills can be taken out into the field.
Okay, so I'd like the term. It's a sort of first aid. And so what is that you mentioned is kind of a toolbox. So could you kind of describe what the components of that toolbox are?
I mean, we briefly touched on, I said a critical incident stress debriefing. So that's one tool in the toolbox, but we have a term called RITS. These are another anagrams. So it's Rest Information Transition Services. So if there's been an incident and we have first responders in the field, as they come out of the field, we would provide them with some rest, some food, we give them information, and then we can either transition them back to the field or we send them home for some rest. So that's another component. That's the other tool. We also have what we call a defusing. So very soon after an event finishes, we would have a defusing session where we bring groups of people in. And these are what we call informational sessions. So the rest information transition, so the RITS tool, and the defusing informational tools, or standing, we call those standing interventions. So we're somebody standing there delivering information. And then we have the critical incident stress debriefing, which is a sit-in. So people sit round and we discuss the event. It's a longer process where people get the opportunity to break down their thoughts and their feelings from the incident. And that's the other tool in the toolbox.
Okay, very good. Thank you for giving us that explanation. So why is this important? So there's a lot of first responders. Obviously, they're search and rescue, which is kind of the main audience of this podcast. But you also have police officers, you have firefighters, emergency medical technicians like yourself, and various other roles that we consider first responders. I'd like to get your thoughts on why CISM is important for first responders to utilize.
Why CISM is important for first responders? Well, it's to mitigate the effects of an incident. There's no magic pills, right? We can't prescribe pills to first responders to get over something that they've experienced. When an incident occurs, it allows them to process the event, to unpack the experience together. We know first responders in general are unlikely to seek formal mental health services because of the fear of repercussions of that. They don't want to be taken off the job or out of the field. So using the peer-based model is something that's, it's evidence-based, it's science-based to show that it really works.
Great. And the assumption that, at least that I'll make there, is that with the peer-based model, people are more likely to talk to their peers about a stressful incident versus a quote unquote outsider. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, very good. So what are the benefits of using CISM? And then what are the potential downsides and impacts of not implementing a CISM program that you've seen in your experience?
Wow, the benefits. I believe that they're infinite with this program. But obviously, if we break it down to the bare bones, it's life-saving. And from my personal experience, I can attest to that. And oh, I wouldn't be here today. And the implications, we could say that they're staggering. Sometimes the chains of life weigh us down in mental quicksand, and it's people, not science, that is able to pull us out. But science has told us that our brains will try to find ways of placing all of the information, especially from an uncommon event. We talk about incidents that happen or disasters. We need to be able to place that information somewhere. So we have a small organ in the center of our brain called the amygdala, which is the seat of all of our stress. I have a little dog, a little emotional support dog, is a Chihuahua called Bentley. And I liken him to the amygdala. He's always vibrating, he's always on alert, just waiting to respond. And when he's triggered, he reacts. So as humans, just as we do, we react in that fight, flight, freeze response. But we cannot stay in the alarm or the alert phase for long periods of time. If you think back to, our high school days, and we remember Maslow's hierarchy or Maslow's pyramid, the bottom layer there is basic needs must be met. So with sleep, with warmth, with food and hydration, we start to lose the ability to process because of poor sleep or poor nutrition. You know, our homeostasis or our balance becomes uneven. We process things when we're sleeping, especially during deep sleep. That's when our brain is most active, processing all of our experiences and what we see and what we smell. But if we drop into poor sleep, that's when things go out of balance. Our homeostasis is out of whack. And the SISM may help restore homeostasis.
Very good. All right. That's a great explanation. So what I'd like to do is I just like to run a quick scenario by you. So one of the things I try to do with this podcast is make things very accessible and practical so that people can implement whatever the suggestion is in their everyday lives. So if you don't mind, Ian, I'm just going to run a quick scenario by you and then just ask some follow-up questions to that specific scenario. How does that sound?
Yeah, sounds great. Go for it.
All right. So let's say there is a SAR team that has a mission, and that mission is for a 4-year-old girl who's gone missing, you know, within the last 24 to 48 hours. And that SAR team goes out on the mission. So just like most SAR teams, there may be multiple operational periods and multiple groups going out into the field. And a group of two people find that missing child. Again, she's about 4 years old. And unfortunately, she is deceased. And more unfortunately, she's died of homicidal violence. So we have a crime scene that we're working through. And so those SAR team members, perhaps they're in the backcountry, and they discovered this young child who has unfortunately died. So the first thing they have to do is secure the crime scene because this is a criminal case. And so because they're in the backcountry, it may take a while for law enforcement to get there. So let's say they have to stay at that crime scene for maybe an hour until law enforcement gets there because they're in the backcountry and they have to secure the scene and stay there until it's taken over by law enforcement. So again, you have two team members, team member A, team member B. They both discovered this child deceased. And so now we have a situation that could be extremely stressful. You have a small child, you have a crime scene, and you have two responders who have to stay there for a longer duration of time due to the geography or the terrain of the place where the child was found at. So first question I want to ask is, how does SISM recommend that we support those two team members as soon as they come back from the field? So let's say they were there for an hour securing the scene, law enforcement's come and taken over the scene. Now they're coming back to base. How can we support them as soon as they return from the field?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the meat and potatoes of the program comes in, right? So as soon as they're returning from the field, we're gonna greet them with our, you know, whatever they need. What are their basic needs? Do they need, you know, food and water? Do they need warmth? Do they need dry clothing? That's something that we can provide as a critical incident stress management team. And that's the first tool in our toolbox, that RITS that I told you about. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to give them information because they might be starved of information. And, you know, we know information is the antidote to chaos, right? We provide information and we settle people down. And once we've given them the information, we've given them rest, we've given them hydration, nutrition, and then we can send them for rest. Sorry, I jumped the gun a bit there. They need to go get some rest.
Okay. Right?
So they need to recover from this. They might not sleep. You know, there's lots been going on here.
Right.
So then they, you know, maybe we bring them back a little while later and they need some more information. We have some more information so we can provide a crisis management briefing with them. Mm-hmm. Fill them with all the information that we have. And then, you know, that should cover them coming out of the field. So, you know, when are we going to get together again? We're going to find out all of this information.
Okay. So I'll just restate what I heard and ask you to verify it or correct me if I'm wrong. So when they first come back to the field, we're just meeting their basic needs. So do you need food? Do you need water? Do you need warm clothing? And then we're giving them information. So there's a lot of things that they have missed because they've been out in the field, so they don't see the total picture of what's happening. So you're giving them information. to the totality of the scenario. Is that an accurate assessment of the first few steps that we should be taking?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
All right, very good, very good. So then let's say we get through this incident, we get through the night. So now it's the next day. And so maybe they sleep, maybe they don't. But what should we then do the next day? Because I think a lot of times, as you mentioned earlier, that within the deep sleep pattern, that's where we process and categorize a lot of things that happened during the previous day. Maybe they were able to reach deep sleep, maybe they were not. But how can we, again, through the SISM toolkit, help them the following day after they've had the opportunity to sit down and think through what they've just experienced?
Well, then we're going to grab the next tool in that toolbox is the defusing. So we're going to bring them in, we're going to sit them down, and we're going to have, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. We're going to have a conversation, and we're going to go step by step through the process of that defusing. So we want some information from them. We want some facts, and then we're going to hopefully give them some good information where they can go away from that process. And then we can also offer them some one-on-one support. Do they need to be split up and then come and chat with a peer responder? If that night's sleep was not great, if they're worried about anything, and then we can follow up with them that way. And, in that process, when we hit the right note, no trauma is too deep nor too shallow. So that's when we can really open that door of, there is support for me. And I don't need to shut this away.
Okay, so that next day through the diffusion process, you're giving them the opportunity to speak and talk about their feelings and their experience. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
All right, very good. And I'm just curious, is this typically, and I'm asking this question in the context of search and rescue, where perhaps with your police departments or your fire departments, well, they may just have to report to duty the next day. Search and rescue, you may go out on a search. You may not see that person again, typically for, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, whatever the case may be. So I'm assuming, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you want to do this in person. But have you ever had an opportunity where you had to do this remotely or perhaps through the COVID time period?
Yeah, I mean, Zoom and Teams was a big thing that came in during the COVID period. So, we say that remotely doing this is not the best, but it's all we had. So something is better than nothing.
Mm-hmm. Was it still pretty effective when you did it remotely?
Yes, I believe so. I truly believe in this process and this toolbox that we have. And, I know it works from my experience and I've seen it work with other people. And I just can't be passionate enough about this stuff.
All right. Very good. So then we move past the next day and we've gone through the diffusion process. What about in the coming days and weeks? A lot of times when we're not in the middle of something, it quickly fades from our mind. But for the people who are a part of a situation, it stays with them very closely. So how can we support our teammates, in the coming days and weeks after an incident of this manner?
Okay, so we've still got that toolbox and we're going to grab the next big tool that we have. This is the CISD or the Critical Incident Stress Debriefing. So this is our bigger process where we bring them back again, maybe 5 days, a week after the event. And then they've had time to go back to their normal lives and they've had time to try to process everything that's gone on and the information that they've had. But now we're going to sit them down and go through a structured seven-step or seven-phase process. And we're going to draw out anything. We're going to take them through a roller coaster of emotions. We're going to take them from their cognitive affective state down into their emotional state. And then we're going to hopefully send them away into, maybe they won't feel better after the process, but it's this beginning of healing because they can really process what's gone on with them and the information that they've been dumped on.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that a challenge, Ian? Are people generally willing and ready to share how they're feeling, or is that something that maybe you have to coax out of them?
I think this is where the power of the peer comes in because, you know, I've had this experience where people say, you know, I don't want to be here, or I don't want to go to this thing. You know, we're just sitting around talking about our emotions. I'm not comfortable with that. But then, you know, they come along and they see somebody else share their emotion or their thought process, and they go, wow, if it's okay for them to do it, it's okay for me to do it. And that's the true power of the peer, because, you know, the person sitting next to you might not need the process, but just by being there encourages other people to take part in that process.
How do the peers go about kind of digging deeper? Is it a situation where you're trying to relate to the experience that the other person had? Or is it a situation where you're just sitting back and listening? Like how would you recommend, or how have you implemented this program, and how do peers go about doing that? Is it, hey, I know what you're feeling because I've went through X, or is it just, can you tell me how you're feeling?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I suggested in the critical incident stress debriefing, CISD is a 7-phase process. So we, you know, we're sort of stick handling them. We set them up on the, you know, like the roller coaster when it goes over the edge and it picks up its own traction. So, you know, with the 7 phases are the introduction. So we introduce ourselves, they introduce themselves, and then we ask them for the facts of the call or the incident that they've been involved in. And then they deliver the facts to us because, you know, this is not our story to tell, it's their story to tell. So we're there just to facilitate their conversation, basically, and we guide them through it, you know, like the driver of the train. We just release the brake and it goes, and then we keep dropping in different phases. We take them through their thoughts and their reactions, any symptoms that they may be having, and then we go into a teaching phase where we teach them, you know, how to overcome any symptoms from their reactions. And then we enter the last phase, which is re-entry, where we don't want them to leave emotional. We want them to leave back into their cognitive state that they came in the room with.
Very good. And so is this debriefing, is it a team of peer responders? Is it one peer responder plus the people who were actually at the incident? Like, how many people are generally a part of this debriefing?
Yeah, so depending on how many search and rescue members have been on the call, we take sort of 2 to 3 peer responders. And then depending on the type of call, you know, you mentioned it was a 4-year-old that deceased, homicidal. So we'd probably bring in a mental health professional as well, just to oversee the process to make sure people are not diving too deep and not recovering from that. So we have somebody of support on hand should they need further or a higher level of mental health intervention.
All right. Very good. Very good. So if you don't mind, could you tell us just really quickly, walk through what the 7 steps are again of the debriefing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the 7 phases or the 7 steps is the introduction is step 1. So for me, the introduction can be part of the most powerful piece because it lays the groundwork, you know, all the ground rules, what we do and don't do. Once we've done our introductions, you know, who are we?
Mm-hmm.
They want to know what our qualifications are. Why are we there? Who are we to be taking them through this process? And then we go into the facts. So the facts of the story, you know, this is their story to tell. So tell me about it. What happened? What was your role? And then the thought process, you know, since the event, how has your thoughts been? What are you thinking about? Can you tell me about that? Tell me about your thoughts when the incident happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reaction phase. So any types of reactions that you're having, you had then, you're having now. And then the symptoms. Are you having any symptoms? Like, i.e., I'm not sleeping or I'm not eating. Those sort of things. And then the teaching phase, where we listen to what they've been telling us, and then we deliver some information back to them to try and help them move on, because they still have to function post critical incident stress debriefing. And then the re-entry phase is where we bring them back to their cognitive state, and then send them off.
All right. Very good. Very good. So one of the things that I've personally struggled with, and so I'll assume others have, is, you know, how do you approach a person who's gone through a situation like this? Is it okay to just say, hey, how are you doing? Or is it better to ask more deeper questions to say maybe, hey, how are you processing this scenario? Like, what types of questions should team members in the days and weeks after an incident occurs, like, what are the right types of questions to ask someone?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you go to my website after this, you'll see one of the questions I have on there. Are you okay? You know, that's something I love to ask people. And how are you doing? You know, I'm going to bring you back to something that just happened recently. So you probably heard of Elmo from Sesame Street.
Yes.
All right. So just a couple of months ago, at the end of January 2024, you know, he asked, how's everybody doing? Just that simple question. Wow. Did that open up the floodgates? So it got, where's my figures here? I think it got over 200 million views, and there was 15,000 responses. You know, even celebrities got in on the act. You know, it basically created this trauma dump, as they called it in the New York Times, I believe. So how's everybody doing? You know, one of the first responses was, oh, Elmo, sweetheart, we are not doing well. I'm mentally burnt out, and I have a lifetime of working to go. You know, one of the celebrities that got in on it said, I'm just looking for somebody to talk to and to show me some love, if you know what I mean. Most people wrote thank yous, you know, for checking in. Thank you for checking in. So, how are you doing? Man, that can just bring people down from maybe a height, and maybe they're feeling stressed about their day, and somebody says, hey, are you okay? Wow, is that so powerful? And, you know, Elmo said at the end of all of this, you know, he was glad that he asked the question, and what he learned from it is that it's important to check in.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I think that's incredibly powerful. So I hope the people who are listening to the podcast took note of that, because the simple question, how are you doing, can open up someone who may not necessarily want to talk. And maybe they don't want to approach someone to talk about it. But if you approach them and just ask a simple question, perhaps that'll be the key to open up their heart and their mind to you. So I appreciate you sharing that with us, Ian.
You're welcome.
Are there specific signs that team members should look for from someone who may be struggling? So after the fact of an incident that may have occurred, again, in the days and weeks later, should look for specific signs. Maybe the person is irritable. Maybe they're upset. Maybe they're drinking an abnormal amount of alcohol. What are some of the signs that we should look for to say, hey, this person may be struggling with what they've gone through?
Yeah, I think, you know, all of those things you just said is, you know, sleep, diet, emotions, drinking, smoking, or, you know, all of the things that we hold so bad in our lives. You know, again, going back to that question, hey, how you doing? You know, and someone might just say, you know, I'm just not sleeping. And then, you know, we go back to what we've talked about before, you know, in that deep sleep is when we process. So this will tell you that they're not processing the experience that they just had. You know, we either eat too much or we don't eat enough. There's no in between there. So, you know, maybe they're going to get junk food every day. Maybe, you know, they're drinking sugary drinks all the time, or monster drinks, you know, the energy drinks, you know, which we know science has told us that they're bad when we're in this fight, flight, freeze response, because the chemicals, our natural chemicals in our body, are out of balance. So filling it with all of these chemical drinks is not good for the system. You know, that's not going to play with your sleep. It's going to affect your sleep. Mm. You know, emotions, you know, is your best friend angry, or are they crying a lot? You know, these things are done best with peers, because peers know the people that they're with, right? So If you and I are in a room and I know you, and you know you're stinking of cigarettes or what, and that's not normal for you. So then there's the red flags to say something's happening here.
I see. So what you're saying is it's not a specific thing. It's looking and seeing something abnormal from that person, abnormal behavior from what they typically do, and that could possibly be a sign. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always encourage routine, right? Routine is what grounds us mainly. So if when you get home from work, you have a glass of red wine, continue to have that red wine. You know, people will say, oh, alcohol is so bad for you, you shouldn't be doing that. But if that is your routine, continue to do that. It's when you're having three or four glasses of red wine, then we know that something's going on. It's not normal behavior.
I see. So that's a great point. It's a question I didn't think to ask, but you raised it. So I do want to ask, if someone has gone through a particularly traumatizing situation, what would you recommend for them in the days and weeks afterwards? So you mentioned routine. Are there any other recommendations that you'd make for someone who's listening who may has gone through something like this?
Yeah, I mean, always routine is the big one, right? Continue to do what you always do, because when we change routine, we get out of balance. We get discombobulated. Like, what's going on here? You know, I like to get up at 5 and I like to go to bed at 9, but this is not happening. So things are starting to go wrong. You know, I think bad things are not going to stop happening. That's the thing that we need to tell people. So just because you've been through this incident, it's not going to stop other bad things happening. So stay with that routine so we can get you through this one ready for the next one.
All right, that's great. What signs should a team member look for to say that this person may need additional help? So perhaps they need to reach out to a mental health professional. Are there any triggers that you've seen in your experience where you say, well, this person really needs to reach out to a professional psychologist or a professional counselor, whatever the case may be? What should we look for in situations like that?
I think all of the things we just spoke about, and then it's time. So if after, I don't know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, and these things are still going on, then, you know, this is the time we should be seeking a higher level of mental health therapy for them. You know, whether it's a psychologist or a psychotherapist, or it's just, you know, structured counseling for them.
All right. And so then I do have to ask the question, and I think you've kind of addressed it, but I do want to take it head on, because a lot of first responders are kind of that type A personality, and they'll, you know, they're bulls in a china shop, and they'll do it their own way, and they don't want any help. So ultimately, I think it's inevitable that we'll run into situations where we want to help and we see someone struggling, but they just do not want help and they want to do it their own way and they won't listen to anyone. What would you recommend to team members who are going through a situation like that with a fellow team member who's gone through a situation, maybe showing warning signs and just refuses help?
Yeah, I mean, that old adage, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but, you know, we can't make them drink. It's unfortunate, right? This is a voluntary process. We all have choice. So if somebody chooses that for themselves, you know, all you can do is be a friend, like be there and just trying to keep encouraging them. You know, we talk about this slippery slope, you know, and we're not diving too deep where we're going down the route of suicide here. This is not that conversation, right? But we know, you know, human connection is suicide prevention. So if somebody is refusing the help and you can see that they're on that slippery slope, is just be there for them. Just give them the time together. Maybe that will just bring them to a point where they'll be willing to accept some formal help.
All right. Very good. So then let's transition away from our scenarios. And I want to ask just a few kind of higher level questions, excuse me. So how do SAR teams implement SISM programs? So they listen to this episode and say, we absolutely need to do that. How do they go about doing it? Are there resources available that they can pull from?
Yeah, I mean, there's many resources out there. You know, critical incident stress management post-pandemic is obviously picking up more and more steam, that people are realizing the worth of it. But you know, you can visit the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, which is icisf.org. There's lots of resources on there. There's even a page that they will help you set up critical incident stress management teams. Or at the end of this podcast, you'll probably have my information. You can reach out to me and I can assist you to find those resources.
All right, very good. One of the things that you mentioned earlier in the episode is that you currently travel around, I believe you said, and help teams implement CISM programs. What impacts have you seen from doing that?
Just, I mean, you know, one of the biggest things is unit cohesiveness and, you know, reduction of sick time, you know, especially in the workplace, and reduction of people not showing up, especially in volunteer organizations. You know, when they experience something tragic, you know, the first thing is just to stop going, stop attending, because, you know, they say, I didn't sign up for this. So I think it's just team cohesiveness and then the understanding that, you know, these things are going to happen, but we're going to carry on. We can carry on.
All right, very good. So one of the things it's important, I think, to ask is, I know certainly in the US there's a lot of SAR teams, and some of them have reasonable budget, some of them have very little budget, some of them have a large number of people, some of them have very, very few number of people. So if a person is listening and they say, I want to implement a program on my team, like how much work is it? How much time does it take? Is it resource intensive or is it accessible enough for basically any team, even if I just have 10 members of my team to implement this program within my local team?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, numbers are not relevant here, right? If there's only 10 members on the team, we can implement critical incident stress management to them, whether they reach out to a neighboring team or if they're doing it in-house. Then, you know, if they're nonprofit, there's lots of funding out there for nonprofits to try and get funding for these programs in the mental health initiative.
All right, very good. So one of the things we always like to do is for folks who join the episode, or excuse me, the podcast that are in search and rescue, we like to give you the opportunity to talk about a memorable search or two that you've been a part of in your career. So do you have any searches that you'd like to tell the listeners about?
Wow, yeah, where do I start with that? There's many over the years. I guess one of the biggest searches that I've been involved in, which was locally here, and involved an Australian national that was over here working. They worked for a large organization, and yeah, they'd gone hiking and they didn't never returned. And so we were activated to go search. I think we were involved in, I think it was seven or eight operational periods, so over 7 to 10 days. And then, you know, the police, the law enforcement agency is the incident commander in these situations. So they made the decision that, you know, we're going to stand this down, or suspend the search, as they call it. And, you know, it got a lot of traction in the press because it had gone over a long period of time. There was lots of people talking about it. And then the Australian Prime Minister actually got involved because it was an Australian national. So if I might be wrong, but I think I have my facts correct that the Australian PM spoke to the Canadian PM, who then reached out to the BC Search and Rescue. And we were asked to go back out in the field. And we did go back out there, and then we went back out. I think the parents asked us to go back out 2 months later, and we went back out, and that's when we recovered her remains, unfortunately. But we provided that closure to that family, which, you know, when we can't return people alive to them, just offering closure is the best that we have, and that's the most powerful piece for me.
Very good. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. All right, so final question, and some of these things you mentioned earlier, but I'm going to ask you to walk through them again because I think this is crucially important for people to have this information. And as a FYI to the listeners, everything that Ian mentions here, I will post in the show notes and on Facebook, so you'll be able to grab it from there as well. So Ian, if people have questions, can they contact you? And if so, how do they get a hold of you?
Absolutely. I said this is my passion. I'm going to steal a quote from Ted Lasso right now. He says, "I believe in hope. I believe in believe." And I've taken that, all the education that I do. I have the Ted Lasso poster up in Believe. So yes, you can reach out to me at the end of the show. You said I have a website. I have an email. You can have my cell phone. Texting is a great way. We do lots of connecting via text these days because people are more comfortable with that. So absolutely, you can reach out and ask questions.
Very good. And would you mind just giving the listeners your email address for us?
My email address is Ian, so it's IAN at Talking Trauma, so talkingtrauma.com.
Very good. And could you restate the name of the international schism organization that you mentioned earlier
So
and
it's
their
the inter
website?
yeah, absolutely. Sure. It's the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, and it's the ICISF.org.
All right, very good. And again, to the listeners, we will post that information in the show notes and on the Hunt Find Alert Facebook page. Well, Ian, this has been great. I think this is something that we, again, as SAR folks, seem to do a fairly reasonable job of ignoring. But as you mentioned multiple times, this is so crucial because ultimately, at the end of the day, it could save someone's life, or it could save their family life and their relationship. So I'm incredibly grateful for you taking the time to come on and discuss this important topic. I really hope the listeners take the time to reach out to Ian or hop on the foundation's website, start your own CISM program, ask the right questions, get connected with people, and let's make sure to support each other as we're all out here trying to help others. Let's make sure to help ourselves as well. So, Ian, any final thoughts before we adjourn?
Yeah, just to follow on again from that, there's this thing called a negativity bias. Unfortunately, we have more words to describe negative thoughts than we do to describe positive ones. So what you're doing here, this is a positive, and you're getting the word out to assist people. And if they listen and take the information, they can go on and set up these programs. And yeah, reach out to me. I'm willing to travel and educate and certify people in this program. So, keep spreading the word.
Very good. Thank you so much. And thank you all to all the listeners of Hunt Find Alert. As always, safe searching, and we will see you next time.